Blog Talk Radio.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your life. Get up, stand up, stand up for your life. Get up.
Gus Hindenburg sitting here with me, and welcome to Kate Thompson and Gus Hindenburg taking a closer look. How are you, Gus?
I'm fine, thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
And we're going to be talking, as a matter of fact, what's going to be happening tonight on the Kay and Gus show as we take a closer look at various topics is that we are going to be telling people that we are sponsored by Black Wax Moving Images. And we're going to be talking about that a little later on in the program because we're going to give you the whole real deal about Black Wax. By the way, we are in the Black Wax studios in Jersey City.
Now, emphasize Jersey City because those people in New York will assume if it's a first-class operation, it's in New York. So make it clear we're in Jersey City in the studio.
Make sure everybody hears that. Jersey City, New Jersey, everyone. Black Wax. Black Wax, and the wax is spelled W-A-X-X, and you're going to hear a lot more about that. Also, if you really want somebody to do your documentaries, your TV programs, your radio programs, etc., Black Wax with Ty Washington, Ayanna Jones, and Shauna Glover, boy, I'm sorry, Ataki, you know, they're all here, and we're really very glad to be here. I'm surprised. Look at this studio. This is absolutely fantastic. We even have Bob Marley playing. Well, listen, everyone, we just want to tell a little bit about, you know, some of the events that, you know, we were attending this week. We went down to New Jersey Performing Arts Center. There was a tribute going on for Larry Goldman down there because where is he going? What is he doing?
Well, let me back up a bit. Larry was the first executive director of the Performing Arts Center and has been there for 20-some-odd years. He is now leaving. But he's not going anywhere.
Uh-huh.
He is going to build a new building right across the street from the existing Performing Arts Center, which will be for housing for artists and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So he is leaving his long-term tenure as executive director of an institution that everybody said would fail.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, it didn't fail.
Mm-hmm.
And he is leaving as executive director, but he will still be intimately involved in the continued growth of the Performing Arts Center.
We're so glad to hear that he is going because he's such a part of, you know, that whole area downtown Newark. It really is fantastic downtown in Newark, New Jersey, right, guys?
Even at night,
yeah. A lot of people, you know, we did the show with the former governor, Tom King, and when we started doing the video portions of the program along with the radio show, we're going to be talking about that again and also about how you had your construction people. They had to have diversified construction staff and crew because they hadn't had diversified construction crews before in building buildings downtown Newark or any place else in the state of New Jersey. Am I right?
And the state of New York.
Uh-huh. But downtown Newark, they use a completely diversified construction crew.
Correct.
And what did you do? I mean, did they put in a certain amount of man hours or what?
We basically took the position that if we didn't work, you don't work.
Yeah.
If you're construction people want to build this building, you better go find some black plumbers and some black carpenters and some black bricklayers. And they did.
Yeah, and Latinos and women, I should say, also,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Now, why was that? Why was it so hard to have black people working in construction in New York and New Jersey.
It's very typical. New York and New Jersey are among us in the construction industry. Mm-hmm. New York and New Jersey are among the most segregated entities in the entire United States.
Wow.
Historically. And we took a position that if we don't work, nobody works.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the Performing Arts Center. It was Newark Airport. It was building after Rutgers Construction, Essex County College. And that's how we got the workforce integrated.
When you say we, that means your company, Gustav Henningberg Associates, because you were the affirmative action officer for the state of New Jersey?
No, I didn't work for the state of New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
They were the problem.
So how were you involved in that?
The people who were putting the buildings up said, Gus, can you take the steps that are necessary that we have an integrated workforce at Essex County College, at Rutgers, at New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and so on.
So that's how the black workers, Latino workers, women, came to work on the New Jersey Performing Arts Center.
And all of those other buildings I just mentioned.
Now, the same thing happened with you out at Newark Airport.
Correct.
You were responsible, really, in a large part, for desegregation of the airport. How?
Basically the same thing.
The same thing?
When they were expanding the airport, lots of construction, runways, hangars, buildings, and we took the same position. This is public money, and if you don't get some minority folk out here, we're not going to let you build it.
And so that's when you stopped the airplanes from coming in to Newark Airport?
Well, we stopped them for a few minutes.
You stopped them. But anyway.
It didn't take long.
And we understand. We said before they escorted you off the runway.
Into jail. They have the Port Authority has a little jail right there on the airport.
Yeah.
And when I walked out on the runway, and this was a result of hours and hours and hours of trying to get somebody to talk to me, and they were not going to do it. And I had learned enough about airports to know that you can disrupt one very easily. And when there's a foreign object on the runway.
And you were the foreign object.
And I was the foreign. Every plane coming to Newark gets diverted to somewhere else. Those people that left Washington coming to Newark ended up in Pittsburgh. But it worked.
Yeah, it worked. All right. And now, what form did this action take for the airport, for desegregating the airport? For instance, what were some of the demands that you made?
I wanted minorities in the construction workforce.
On the airport, the asphalt.
On the airport.
The runway.
Buildings and painting and all that stuff. There's a lot of construction on an airport.
Yeah.
I wanted minority concessionaires selling hot dogs and whatever. And I wanted minorities owning gift shops.
Yeah.
In other words,
like duty free shops.
There's a lot of business at an airport.
And blacks were kept out of those businesses. Is that it?
There had never been a black concessionaire in the history of Newark Airport.
Mm-hmm.
But now, let's make it clear, nor at LaGuardia Airport. Nor at Kennedy Airport, nor at the Washington, D.C. Airport.
Wow.
Minorities had not focused on the that whole opportunity of concessions at an airport.
Okay, now let's jump ahead. I understand that since you went on the runway, you got the attention of whoever was running the place, meaning the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey. You went to Washington. They asked you, what kind of demands, what else do you want in order to, you know, keep this stuff down. We don't want this happening at the airport anymore, I'm assuming. So you also said at that particular time, I want black businesses or minority businesses. Tell us how that happened.
Well, it
what
all
kind
followed.
Of business?
By going out on the runway, it made very clear to the people who ran that airports are very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you just send one person. You don't have to send a busload out on that runway.
Mm-hmm.
And every airplane coming your way has to get diverted to somewhere.
So that was your leverage then for desegregation. Also, what kind of businesses were there at the airport? There weren't any, but however, there were different. How do you get the businesses together to go out to the airport to try to, you know, have their businesses out there?
Well, let's be more specific. An airport is more than just airplanes.
Yeah.
There are every kind of business out there you can imagine. There are hamburger stands, there are shoeshine stands, there are news stands, there are gift shops, there are in every airport.
Everything.
None of them, and they're the concessionaires, none of them at Newark Airport were minority owned.
Wow.
Not one.
Mm-hmm.
Nor at LaGuardia, nor at Kennedy, nor at Washington, D.C.
Or any other airport.
Nor at Baltimore.
Racism was full force.
Let me use the term, the civil rights movement had not found its way to the airport.
I see.
At that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we tried very hard through meetings, but we weren't getting anywhere. And it occurred to me one day that they're very vulnerable, but they don't quite fully appreciate it.
Yeah.
And the minute I walked out on the runway, all of a sudden, two things happened. They said, "He's crazy. Look at him. He's out there. There are airplanes coming in there." I was saying to myself, "This is crazy.
Yeah.
I'm going home, get back in my bed."
But before you were able to do that, you were whisked off to jail.
Yes, they have a little jail right there on the runway.
Uh-huh.
Not on the runway, but right on the side of the runway.
Now, some of the businesses that you were represented or you got there, for instance, was there a shoe shine, you know, company?
There were two minority concessionaires at Newark Airport.
Concessionaires, you mean the duty free?
Well, everybody selling a product out there is a concessionaire.
I see, okay.
But that's what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
There were two that were minority. One was a newsstand in the old Terminal A lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And people who've been around for a while will remember that before they built all the new buildings and so on. And the other was a shoeshine stand.
Yeah.
Those were the only minority businesses of the 116 businesses at Newark Airport.
Mm-hmm. And they couldn't get any traction or anything, I understand. So what happened? How did you get the other businesses to try to get out there?
Well, when you walk out on the runway, you get everybody's attention.
Including those people with businesses, those minority people with businesses.
No, well, they thought I was crazy.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And some of the white managers at the airport went to the minority concessionaires and said, "Is that a friend of yours out there? If it is, you better tell him to get off our runway."
Uh-huh.
And I had talked to them before I walked out there and told them what I was going to do.
Oh, you did? You did?
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about the minority concessionaires.
Okay.
They were only two.
Uh-huh. And they really thought. But that grew to being how many different businesses out there at Newark Airport because of your demands? Because your demands went all the way to Washington.
Well,
So what are some of the other businesses?
Well, let me explain the Washington thing. Once it became clear that there was a set of people who were willing, at my suggestion, to walk out on the runway, it wouldn't be just me the next time. It might be me and 15 other people.
Yeah.
that's when the powers that be decided we've got to address this problem. Next thing we know, they'll be doing this at Atlanta Airport,
yeah,
Washington Airport, Chicago Airport, and so on. And we had a meeting.
You with the business people had a meeting.
Well, now let me finish this. I had a meeting at Newark Airport with the governor of New Jersey, the CEO of the Port Authority, who owns and operates the airport, and all of the other people who were involved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that meeting, the airport manager said, "Gus, we've got to go talk to the commissioner of transportation for the state of New Jersey." It's the federal government. I mean, the federal government runs these airports.
Yeah.
So, with the chairman of the New Jersey State Chamber of Commerce, who was then Don McNaughton, the CEO of Prudential Insurance Company, the governor of New Jersey, and four or five other very important people. We got on the shuttle one morning, flew to Washington, and met with the Secretary of Transportation and said, you got to fix this.
And they did fix it.
And they fixed it.
Okay, so now let's jump ahead to how many businesses then that came to be at Newark Airport?
I think about 20.
We do have to, you know.
About 24.
All right, about 24. We're going to have to take a break right now. And then we'll come back. And then we're going to be talking about this one because we want to find out what businesses were there. And also we want to find out how you started Duty Free Airport. Black-owned Duty Free Air concessionaires, right? Am I saying that correctly? All around the country. We'll be right back, everyone. Stay with us. I'm Kay Thompson with Gus Henningberg, and this is Kay and Gus taking a closer look. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Who has hurt all mankind? Just a famous whole belief.
One love.
What about a one
arm? One heart.
What about a little?
Get together and feel all right.
As it was in the beginning.
One love.
Oh, shall it be in the end?
One heart.
All right. Is only Armageddon.
One love.
When the man comes, there will be no doom.
One love.
Have pity on those whose chances grow thin. There ain't no hiding place from the Father of creation. Yeah, yeah.
One love.
We are back. Kay Thompson here. Gus Henningberg here. And we are going to be continuing this conversation about the duty, not the day duty free, but the different businesses at Newark Airport and how Newark Airport, which is now, what's the name of the airport now? Newark what? Newark Liberty or Newark International?
Newark Liberty International Airport.
Newark Liberty International Airport. Big airport. Is it one of the biggest in the country?
No.
No. What's the biggest one in the country, you think?
Kennedy
is bigger.
Yes.
Well, a lot of things are going on down there. I mean, that's one really very, very full airport. But anyway, we're going to be getting into that in another time, I would imagine. But I want to let people know that because of your action that you took, one of the businesses that you demanded be put in or be supported at Newark Airport was the duty-free concession. Is that it? Am I saying it correctly?
The duty-free is a very lucrative profession at an airport.
Yeah.
The only people who can buy things in a duty-free store are people getting ready to get on an airplane.
Ah, they're getting ready to get on the airplane to fly.
Somewhere.
Internationally or what?
Wherever, but they can't. You can't walk in and off the street.
And go
not be going anywhere and go buy your gifts and stuff at the duty-free store.
I see.
Duty-free means no tax.
Ah, okay.
That's what duty-free means. And so all the stuff that you buy at a duty-free store, it's a good price because you're not paying any tax on it.
So there are now duty-free concessions all around the country because of the action taken at Newark Airport. Is that correct?
The last time I checked, and it's been a while, there are probably 100.
And just to let those concessionaires know that it started in Newark. At Newark Airport. Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Well, they know it. They are well organized. They mean the concessionaires.
Yeah, it's a fascinating business.
They now have not just duty free, all the concessionaires and newsstands, whatever. They have a conference every year. And they pick nice places to have these conferences. They don't meet on 125th Street.
Yeah, yeah. You know, because I want to talk about the students for a minute also. But before we did that, we did attend a few other events. But there's one I want to talk about. There was a street in East Orange, New Jersey. It was named for the principal of Jackson Academy in East Orange, New Jersey. And I'd like to say congratulations to Gladys M. Calhoun, because the street was named for her. Gladys Calhoun Way, Gladys M. Calhoun Way. And Jackson Academy is an extraordinary school. It really is an extraordinary school. Also, Juneteenth is coming up. And it's going to be a rodeo. And guess where? In Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Oh, there are lots of horses and things like that in Elizabeth. That's an appropriate place.
Anyway, getting back to something about education, we were talking about, so many different things happening downtown Newark, with downtown Newark being a center for higher education. And we had a young lady on with us some time ago, and her name is Millie Harris. And she, her other name as an author is Milagros Milan. And she is an extraordinary teacher. And we know that. Now, aside from being the author, by the way, Millie, welcome once again to A Closer Look.
I'm so glad to be here again. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Now, the book, the name of your book is
Tales from the Underground Evil Lounge.
Okay. And people have been calling about that, and people have been, talking about that book. We're going to get into that, but okay. There's something else going on with social justice with you.
Right.
So I'm going to but we have a call. So let's get to the call. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you are on the air.
You hear me?
I can't hear you.
Hello? You hear me now? You hear me?
Can't hear them. Trying.
Okay. Hello, hello.
Paul isn't coming through to me.
Hello?
I hear you. I hear you outside somewhere, but I can't hear you right now. It's not coming through to me, Mike.
Hello?
Anyway, as soon as we get this problem, we'll come back to them. So the caller will hold on. We'll try to come right back, okay? But Millie Harris, extraordinary teacher.
Well, thank you.
One of the most extraordinary teachers I've talked to, you and Angela and Leon and Angela Christmas, who's here also. Leon Owens down there in Princeton. And doing things that really are making a difference. Now, aside from your being an author, and with the most hilarious book I've ever read in my life,
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, you're an extraordinary teacher, and you are teaching. What do you teach over there at Central High School in Newark?
Well, first of all, let me take this opportunity to brag about Central High School.
Okay.
Because Central High School was one of the schools that was considered to be a failing school. We were able to procure funds from the school improvement grants for $5 million and now are considered a turnaround school. Our scores went up this year exponentially.
Wow.
Which is a testament to the hard work of the faculty, the administration, the staff. I think this was an effort that took everybody, and particularly the children, who really just rose to the occasion and exceeded all expectations, and I say kudos to the kids.
Yeah.
Well, they did a great job.
Kudos to the staff also.
Thank you very much. We did work hard.
Yeah, I know.
We had
a love of children. Yeah, really.
For for the first time ever.
What does that mean, an extended day?
An extended day meant that part of the grant money, that we had to add two periods to the day. So normally our school day for the students ends at 2:40. It was extended to about 4:15.
No kidding. How did that happen? How did the students react to that?
Initially, not so well.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't easy. It was a difficult task to get the kids to really just stay in the building. They had been offered certain extracurricular activities by the time, the program had to be put together very quickly. And not everything was in place. But in spite of that, the one thing that did come out of it, it allowed our third year, our junior students, to participate in a HESPA academy.
Okay. And you're going to explain that in a minute. I have to say this year, I've been to Central High School at your invitation. Ras Baraka, you did not invite me. Anyway, Millie did. And your classes are extraordinary. They
They
are interactive.
Right.
The students are, they don't know what you're going to do next.
No, they have no
And
idea.
You teach with such a unique way that the kids want to be there because they want to see what you're going to do next
right.
and what you're going to say next.
Right.
You allow them such freedom, and at the same time, you pull them together. They're absolutely fascinated with you. I've never seen a teacher like you.
Oh, thank you. That is really great.
Really, and I've taught
really
school. You know, I've
right,
taught,
know.
You know, for a number of
I
years
know.
In Newark
That's
and
right.
William Patterson, et cetera, et cetera. But you have that knack of the love for those kids, and they know it.
I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah,
you
and they know it.
You have to really, you know, teachers are overworked, underpaid, undervalued, and I don't think you can go to a place
yeah.
every single day and start fresh and keep it exciting unless it really matters to
okay.
you. It has to come from the heart. It certainly doesn't come for that paycheck.
Well,
it's barely enough to live.
There's so many things happening in your
yes.
classroom that, you know, it's just, I always want to come to see what's going to be going, what's
yes.
going to be going
and
on
we're
next.
We're doing great things now.
I know.
Really great things.
Want to get to this. Want to get to this that you're teaching social justice.
We teach social justice.
Now,
the,
just let me introduce this because this is
okay.
so fascinating. People are going to be absolutely fascinated with it. You are now involved with the experiences of kids whose parents are incarcerated.
Incarcerated.
What they go through.
Right.
What they go through. And we're going to find out exactly what your approach to this social justice is in just a minute because we do have a caller. And
okay.
let's see if we can get him on the line right now, either him or her. Hello, you're on the air. You are on the air. Hello? Still can't. It's not coming through. So as soon as
Hello?
Get,
Hi, can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. This is Nana Sol, and I just want to say you guys have a wonderful show. I'm just so excited that the Kango show is on.
I'm
Hello?
Sorry, can't do that. We're still trying to work that out. And as soon as we do, we will. But anyway, getting back to you, Millie, the approach to social justice. These kids must go through a whole heck of a lot with the experiences, just the experiences that they have when they go to, you know, the jails.
Right.
The prison
right.
to see
right.
the. So when you approach that, what happened? How did that happen? And
okay, well, with Montclair State University on something called YPAR, Youth Participatory Action Research. This year was the
what
very
is that
first.
Called?
YPAR. YPAR. YPAR.
Okay.
That's what we call it.
Okay.
Youth Participatory Action Research.
Okay.
And what that means is that children need to take agency in their own lives, in their own communities, and they know best about their experiences. So they get an opportunity to research and develop an action plan, present it, and see it through.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first year we did it. We had some degree of success. We went to a YPAR summit at Montclair State University with the students from Montclair High School.
What did that consist of?
That consisted of the two groups presenting issues that were of their concern. Our students brought, I would say, at least a dozen projects.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to present their projects in multimedia. They had made films. They had skits they did, interactives with their audience.
How did you get to the issue of the kids
and incarceration?
Yeah,
I'll tell you because that came out of the YPAR.
Okay,
okay. This program, this youth participatory action research,
did the kids
has been ongoing.
That? Did they suggest that topic?
Yes and no. And part of the reason that they did not overtly suggest it is the fact that incarcerated parents are the dirty little secret. Incarcerated family members are things that the kids do not necessarily openly talk about it, but they are experiences that they're going through in their personal lives. And sometimes they keep their pain to themselves. So when we were at Montclair State, we saw a YPAR project that had been done by Dr. Michelle Fine from NYU on something called Echoes of Incarceration. And it was children doing research and presenting a film about their experiences with the judicial system.
What were some of those experiences?
Well, you know, like kids talking about their homes being broken into in the middle of the night by the police, their parents taken away, you know, ending up in Dyfus, joining gangs because their parents were incarcerated and they really didn't have a support system. What happens when your parent is away and you're a kid who's an achiever?
Yeah.
Do you disassociate yourself, or are they still your loved ones? What about relationships? Do you visit your parents? Do you not visit your parents? These are, and it's not just parents. Let me not just say parents, because it's siblings, it's uncles, it's extended family members. It's
in other words, these kids who are experiencing this have to go through a process when they go to visit, for instance,
of
their
course,
parents or, you know.
Of course. When you go to visit a person in prison, you're like a person who's
in prison yourself. Absolutely.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, seeing them for short periods of time, often having to travel great distances to see them.
All that inconvenience.
And now, as you and I have talked about privately, you know, with Congressman Payne,
mm-hmm.
looking at this issue of funding being cut for prison families, so that eventually these people won't even be able to afford to visit their loved ones.
Not at all.
Right.
Not
so
at
there
all.
Are some serious issues.
Mm-hmm.
So the Social Justice Academy, looking at that and examining the work of Michelle Alexander in a book entitled The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
And she is where?
She's out of Ohio State.
Out of Ohio State,
right.
Okay.
She was an ACLU attorney, now a professor, who really brought to light and really made it clear to everyone. She wrote a very clear and concise research piece, beautiful book, that explains, you know, our kids are being incarcerated at record rates.
Yeah.
They're going
yeah.
straight from high school to the penitentiary.
And that's the kind of thing that you're working on
and
now.
This is a movement around the country.
Yeah.
Now, we have
trying trying to stop this movement from school to jail for minority communities.
And, of course, the escalating violence in Newark, the gang violence, all of these things that are creating this cycle of hopelessness and despair. But unfortunately, people adapt to despair. So they really need to look at this with a critical eye.
When you started this, you know, talking to the students about this, you know, what was your reaction to that? Were you amazed? Were you, you know,
yes
how,
and no.
How did you
I was,
feel doing
this? I was, I'm always moved by their stories. And I'm moved by their resilience.
Did they seem to want to talk about it?
Not initially. They're reserved initially. You know, when Michelle Fine did come to our school, actually yesterday, and spoke. And, you know, initially the kids will approach it with maybe a question here or there about them. And then eventually they move into questions about you.
Yeah.
And then finally when they start saying, you know,
my experience,
that's when you know it's hit home, and our kids are so incredibly involved and engaged. But I do have to tell you the other part of this.
Yes, go right ahead.
I have a personal friend who has been incarcerated for 23 years now. He was the third person in the country to receive a super kingpin statute, which carries the penalty of life without the possibility of parole. He's very well known in Newark. His name is Wayne Akbar Prey.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you know, I knew him back in the day.
He is presently incarcerated
for, you know, life with no parole. So anyway, long story short, I decided to reach out. And when I found him, I found that he was doing the same type of work inside the prison for years. For these years that he's been incarcerated, he's been working with young prisoners and increasingly younger and younger prisoners that are serving longer and longer sentences. Longer and longer sentences, and that are leaving the prisons more ill-prepared than ever.
For anything. They can't do anything.
Society.
In other words, they're not.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is part of this caste system that's developing as a result of this mass incarceration of people of color.
Wow.
So in talking to Mr. Prey and realizing that what he was doing on the inside was very similar to the work that I'm doing on the outside as a teacher and trying to engage the kids in, you know, some activities that are meaningful for them. And ultimately the goal that we decided to come to together was to work through his works that he's already established,
okay,
to get this message out to these kids long before they leave high school.
Has that been difficult for him to do, to get messages out into the community from where he is?
He has been amazingly resourceful.
Uh-huh.
He's published 2 books,
uh-huh,
a third in the works. He has an incredible CD entitled Akbar Prey Speaks to Urban America.
I see. Uh-huh.
His tale is a cautionary tale on many levels,
uh-huh,
and that's what he presents to the kids.
When he is involved with this, I mean, how is he treated in the prison?
He was a person who commanded a lot of respect,
uh-huh,
outside of prison,
uh-huh,
and inside of prison because of the work that he's doing. And that's from the institutions themselves, because he has been doing very good work.
Okay, now this leads me to asking Gus about his experiences when you went to, was it Rahway or Trenton prison?
Rahway.
Now, what happened with that was that the prisoners wanted to get information out to the officials, and they called you down to negotiate, or what?
No, the prisoners rioted in Rahway Prison.
Mm-hmm.
Not long after the riots, it got much more fame up at Attica,
yeah,
in New York. In New York, the then governor, Rockefeller, sent troops in with guns and shot up a lot of people.
Yeah.
That happened in New Jersey a few months later. The then governor of New Jersey said...
The rioting happened. The shooting didn't go on in New Jersey, right?
No, I mean the problem in the prison.
Okay.
But the governor, the prisoners went on a strike. And the governor of New Jersey said, I'm not going to do what my friend, the governor of New York, did.
Who was the governor at that time? Was that Cahill?
Yes.
Okay.
He was going to approach the problem that Rockefeller had approached by shooting people up.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to try to find another way to do it. And that's how I got there. He called me and asked if I would go into the prison and help into Rahway, try to find out what the problems are, what can we do about it, and so on. So that's how I got there.
Yeah. Did the prisoners ask for you also, or what?
I don't know.
You don't know, but you went there. Did?
But I must admit.
Were you able to get what they wanted, you know, out to the governor and people, or what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the first question I got when I was being taken into the prison, because the prisoners who were rioting were all lined up against the cells.
Yeah.
Just trying to see what's going on out, mm-hmm, there. And I came in, and all of a sudden, I hear, Gus, what are you doing here?
A lot of your friends in prison.
A lot of my friends are on the other side of the bar over there.
Uh-huh.
But we were able to negotiate a settlement at Rahway Prison, unlike what had happened in New York.
Mm-hmm. And what happened as a result? Did the officials go along with it, or what?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. All right. Without any killings or deaths or anything like that?
There was no rioting in the prison.
The prison personnel weren't listening to them then.
That's correct. That was one of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That is something that the kids have to go through.
And let me make this other quick observation. There's a place about a half a mile south of Rahway Prison, a training facility.
Uh-huh.
And wardens of every other prison in New Jersey were at Rahway because it was the biggest of all of them.
Yeah.
And they were down in this place just south of Rahway Prison. And the governor was down there with them, and they were screaming, these wardens of other prisons were screaming at the governor, bring the state police in and shoot them.
Mm. Wow.
And the governor was, all of his instincts said, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And these wardens were saying, they're not going to listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to talk to you. And who is that pointing at me?
Mm-hmm.
I was not well known among the prisoners, the wardens in the prison in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But the governor stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
And two or three other people and I went into, after being fully briefed, went into the prison, spent about 2 days talking and communicating and negotiating, and settled it with no shots being fired.
Yeah.
Nobody got killed at all in prison.
Okay. All right. We are running out of time. We're going to have to take a break if we will come back. Again, Millie, we're going to be talking to you more about this and more about what your experiences are regarding this particular project, because it is something to, you know, really look at very, very seriously. So my name is Kay Thompson, and your name is?
Gus Henningberg.
And your name is? Okay, we're going to come back, and who knows, maybe we will be able to get a call caller on the phone. The reason why we couldn't is because it's not coming through on the microphone, so please hang in there with us, everyone. We will be right back.
Follow me, follow me, follow me, follow me.
Okay. Give me what number? And we are back, everyone. Kay Thompson here. Gus Henningberg is here. Millie Harris is here. And we're talking about the experiences of students of high school kids, children, period, whose parents are incarcerated. And we're talking about people who are doing things about it around the country. And we're talking about Millie Harris and her work at Central High School under one of our academies, which is the Social Justice Academy. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. What have you learned, you know, as a result of this kind of thing, knowing, of being, you know, did you come up with this portion of it and dealing with it the way that you're dealing with it?
You mean my own personal experience?
Yeah.
No.
No, I mean with the kids. Did you figure out your own, in other words, to get to them to open up?
How did you do that? Yeah, the best way to get to the children to open up is to share your own experiences with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, the kids are by nature skeptics.
Yeah.
So once they realize that they can be comfortable with you, that they can be themselves with you, then they begin to share. And
yeah.
They begin to open up. And then you really also begin to see them shine.
Yeah.
Because they are amazingly resilient children.
Yeah. And they probably have been wanting to tell these experiences
for a long time.
Anyway.
I also want to mention, because you were talking about the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and we have a partnership with them also. And just last week, our social justice dance and theater did a performance called Writing Myself into Being or something like that. It was poetry, dance, written and performed by the kids.
So
New Jersey PAC has proven to be a wonderful partner.
We're hearing music in the microphones right now, so I hope that everybody can hear us as we're trying to talk over the music, because this is really a fascinating subject. You know, some of the other things I want to talk about, you know, for instance, you know, I think I mentioned to you or I talked earlier about kids who are going into college now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is, you know, going a little further afield from what
we were
talking
hearing
about.
All the music while we were
so,
talking.
But this one girl who said that she was, her father's black and her mother is Asian. And what the kids are doing now is deciding on the mixed, you know.
What they're
mixed kids.
Okay.
They are deciding what they should say about their backgrounds, whether they should be black, whether they should be Asian, whether they should be Indian, whether they should be white.
Oh,
you know, because if it's going to affect their college, getting into college.
She
was saying that she wants to say, she's going to say, I'm black.
Right.
And then that
for affirmative
may mean,
action.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that may mean, she says that that may mean that she is really insulting her mother.
Right.
My words, not hers. But,
right,
you know,
right, right.
The gist of it in the paper.
Right.
Is it really interesting?
It is very interesting. When you're thinking in terms of social justice in a society that's so stratified and racial constructs and things of that nature, yes, it does become fascinating. And
it becomes so complicated now.
It is complicated.
That we never even dealt with yet.
And that we did not have to deal with. That's true.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's try again. This caller again. You are on the air. Hello. Hopefully we can.
Hi, this is Mama Soul. How are you?
Hi. I hear you, but I don't hear you. Can you say it again?
This is Nana Soul.
This is Nana Soul. Okay, Nana Soul, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Great job. You guys have a fantastic show. I'm really proud of you.
Fascinating show. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I had a question actually for your guest because, you know, there are some disparities. Yes.
Okay, we're trying to hear you in here still.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yay! Okay.
I actually had
a question for your guest, Millie.
Yes. Go right ahead.
So my question is, you know, there are a lot of disparaging remarks made about Newark in general, particularly the crime and the educational system out there. So hearing about this school that's doing so many fantastic things, especially towards social justice,
What's the difference between working in a school with that kind of curriculum and, say, other public schools? And what's the problem? Why can't they seem to figure out the model that you guys have obviously figured out at the School for Social Justice?
Well, I think the difference is student engagement. I mm-hmm. think that the students are very involved because these are matters that are very real to them and salient. I think that possibly one of the reasons that these techniques and models are not being used in other places is because, unfortunately, students are not necessarily the people with the largest voice when it comes to their education. So I would say that students are not being heard in terms of what they're saying that they need and they want. And the second least heard would be teachers who are, you know, in the trenches with the kids. And recognize that, you know, you need incentives. You need something to motivate you to learn. And if the learning is something that is applicable to your life and you see immediate results from it and it gives you a sense of agency, then you're empowered in many different ways.
You have really touched on the key word, motivating.
Right.
The kids have to want to come to school.
Absolutely.
They want to have a voice, but and right. teachers and educators, period, have to allow them to have that voice. And if you can get a student to the point where he trusts you enough to give himself to that teacher, because the teachers do have some involvement with it. Central High is a very unusual school.
I think
it's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. I know some of the teachers there. And what they do is really extraordinary. Because
well, we
the
try to do innovative things.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus you have a genuine, like, Kids can sense things,
oh,
as you know, I've taught, you know.
Absolutely.
And if you generally don't have a feeling of what mm-hmm. they're feeling, or if you can't do that, you just maybe shouldn't be there.
Absolutely.
But the point is, it takes a lot.
Yes.
And teachers who do this, you know, are really, they're doing a Herculean
job. They are
job.
Doing a wonderful job. So, and I can tell you that the people who have, what our project is for next year, we've been beginning to introduce some of it this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who come into the building in the middle of June are amazed at how engaged the students
yeah.
are. I mean, they are really, really on their grind and involved because of the nature of this project that we're doing.
Okay, you know, I want to give out the number for people to call. I think this is the number 323-679-0906. And you can call in on that number, callers, 323-679-0906. 323-679-0906. I almost want to say this is WLRB Radio. Guess what about you? You want to say this is Positively Black or something? That's right. We did talk to a lot of people. As a matter of fact, we had a segment called Police Report on.
Right.
And that was with Dr. Ali Al-Rahman.
Mm-hmm.
And he had brought in police persons who were of the community, from the community, because people complained about certain police brutality
mm-hmm.
issues,
absolutely.
which were rampant
right.
at that particular time.
They're still rampant.
Yeah.
Don't get
well,
yourself.
Okay.
They're still rampant.
Okay. And, you know, we would have the police report, the police persons and who were chosen
mm-hmm.
by Dr. Ali Al-Rahman. And, you know, they would also tell people what to do. There was a civilian, what was that, the name of that, review board or something, that really people could not really completely count on at all. There was the Civilian Complaint Review Board.
Mm-hmm.
I remember giving out numbers and, you know, people calling and saying they weren't
mm-hmm.
doing anything. And it was really very frustrating.
Right.
Because
and
there was so much
too.
Happening at that review. There was the Yusuf Hawkins case. Mm-hmm. There was, oh, God, the Korean stores that
mm-hmm.
happened. The Eleanor Bumpers case, the Mary Carson case, you name it, I can go down
right.
a whole list.
Mm-hmm. But
there was a kid who had schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of them treating this young man in a certain way, because I had had the parents that came on talking about, you know, schizophrenia.
Right.
And they were saying that their children, their adult right. children, had to be treated in a certain way. This kid had ended up killed because of the
wow.
fact that the police weren't, you know, weren't trained enough. Eleanor Bumpers, for instance, the grandmother.
Right,
you
I
know,
remember
was shotgunned
that.
Today.
I
that should
that
never have it ha- never had happened. And I mentioned before last week about Reverend Dr. Herb Daughtry Guts over there in Brooklyn. He is still there with his church. He has this in his church. I'm assuming. I'm quite sure he's still there. But he had this wall of tears which, you know, you saw killings of people by the police department.
By the police department.
You know, so, and...
Well, I wouldn't say it's quite
say,
that bad
yeah,
in
yeah.
Newark right now, but yes,
reason,
the kids will be the first to tell you that, yes, that they are treated differently by police officers. And interestingly enough, sometimes worse by black officers.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, I'm not saying that we should come down on police officers.
No,
I want to get
no.
In, but I have heard of so many things.
But
when
you
I
have
was
to be
WLS.
Aware that people have rights, and they have to be they have to know their rights and exercise their rights.
Yeah. Well, we have 5 minutes left on this particular piece, and we're going to be keeping up with this. But right now, you know what? I want to let people know about Disappearing Voices, the Decline of Black Radio. This is a documentary. While not a complete history of black radio, the film offers the viewers a well-rounded discourse that touches on the impact of black jocks, not only on radio, but also on the very fabric of American life. And this film is by Black Wax. By the way, directed by Eusebio Washington. Now, this is replete with rare interviews with prominent figures in American society, like Melvin Van Peebles, the Reverend Al Sharpton, Chuck D of Public Enemy, Kay Thompson, the last poet, and so many other people, with air checks by famous jocks like Frankie Hollywood Crocker. I knew Frankie. He was really something, I tell you. We know all the inside things. We're going to be revealing some of this, you know, when we get into the videos that we have of the different people. We're going to be showing these videos. The Dixie Drifters, Jocko Henderson, Hal Jackson, Eddie O.J. Okay. Disappearing Voices does more than examine the factors that contributed to black radio's demise, because it is, you know, just practically non-existent. It is an expose, a history lesson, and a memoir, and a source for solutions. And again, it's directed by Eusebio Washington, who is also the founder here of Black Wax. And I can't say enough about Black Wax, because they're the reason why we're here. So again, I'd like to say thanks to Ty, and like to say thanks to Ayana, to Tati, to Shauna, and everybody else who's involved here. And we are going to be going into another segment. I don't know how much time do we have. It's about 3 more minutes, but we're going to be going into another segment. This is going to be the segment involving Sahima's story. Remember, we started with Sahima last week, and Sahima was incarcerated in jail in the Philippines for 8 years because of the fact that she was she moved drugs. You know, she was a mule dealing with drugs, and she'll tell you when she gets here that she should have been incarcerated. She makes no bones about that. But I want her to continue with her story, because it's really, really, really fascinating. She survived 8 years. I think she was one person who was the longest American prisoner in a foreign country, but she'll tell that in part two of this. And the experiences that she had was really, really awful. And she hasn't told really all of it. So we're going to, talk to her about that and see what's going on. But I'd like to say, too, we have a lot of people who are supporting this. And one of the supporters and the supporters of the student, of this show, rather, A Closer Look, with Kay Thompson and Gus Henningberg, is Black Wax Records. I'd also like to say out there to Jim Drury from Jimmy Cat. You know, they're supporting us also. And Don Scales. You know, I got a call from Don Scales, who is my cousin, who is in Iraq.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I'm supposed to say hello to Don Scales. Hi, young man. I hope everything is fine. And we'll be talking to you again. You're going to be coming back, right?
Oh, I have so much more to tell you.
I know. I want to hear all about it. You know, because whatever we can do, you know, for our kids, I don't care what it is. You know, to try to keep them going. You know,
keep them empowered.
Yeah, and we talked to Gus about it. You know, construction jobs. A lot of people don't have to go on to higher education.
Absolutely.
That may be desirable, but not everyone wants to go on to higher education.
It's just about going to gainful employment.
That's right. It's about, you know, being able to make money to survive
and support your family.
You know, absolutely, absolutely. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be coming back to you. We're going to be talking to Sahima, and hopefully, you know, her son Hanif is with her. So maybe we'll get to talk to Hanif. Gus Henningberg, we're going to be taking a break around about now, and we will be right back in case Anybody wants to call in, I'm Kay Thompson with Gus Henneberg. Call this number, 323-679-0906. That's 323-679-0906. We'll be right back, everyone.
Thank you.
And we are back, and we are back. Kay Thompson here with Gus Henningberg, and we are taking a closer look at several different issues here tonight, and hope that you're still staying with us. We have another hour to go, and the number for you to call is 213-673-679-0906. That number, once again, is 323-679-0906, just in case you want to call in and talk to us. Right now, on this segment of the show, we are going to be talking to and inviting back Sahima to tell her story, the story of Sahima. And, Sahima, I'm not going to say your last name.
No.
No, okay. Also, your son Hanif is here. Hanif is here. Just put it down. And, because it is a little loud in our ears. But before we do that, I want to tell people that On the Move is a double CD packed with 20 tracks and over 90 minutes of music and spoken word spanning several genres, including hip-hop, jazz, R&B, rock, and spoken word. Those lending their voices to this powerful collection range from Renaissance to world-renowned artists such as Grammy winners Public Enemy, Maya Azucena, and Living Color, Abiodun Oyewole, of the world-famous Last Poets, who are internationally credited as the godfathers of rap, Philadelphia-born Resu's song They Say Vision hit number one Billboard chart, internationally acclaimed jazz and R&B vocalist Stephanie Rice, Immortal Technique, one of the most well-known unsigned rappers in the world, two-time National Endowment for the Arts winner Fred Ho, and two-time John Lennon songwriting contest winner Nana Soul. Congratulations to Nana Soul. For more information on disappearance of Black voices and Black radio, visit www.blackwax.com. That's www.blackwax.com. And how you can get to the Kay and Gus show is to go to, what do we go to? We go to live radio blog. Exactly. I forgot for a minute. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio, and then you just type in blogtalkradio.com, and then you just talk in the K and Gus show. K is spelled, by the way, K-A-E, so if you write in K-A-Y, we're not going to get it, but feel free to do that. By the way, you know, I've been trying to get in touch with Dr. Ben. I hope everything is okay with him, and I've tried to get, I used to have every number that he gave me, the numbers in Egypt, the number at his house, his apartment, you know, in New York. And, but now I can't get in touch with him because I misplaced some of his numbers. So I'm appealing to people who used to listen to us on WLIB. We have a volume of part one and part two of Dr. Van Sertimer, Dr. Clark, and Dr. Len Gunther. By the way, Dr. Len Gunther is going to be at one of the churches in Elizabeth this weekend coming, by the way, for Juneteenth. But trying to get in touch with Dr. Ben. Want to see what's happening with him. Want to get him on the phone. So, everyone, welcome once again to you.
Thank you.
And welcome to you, honey.
Thank you.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a long time. So you've been hearing about the work that Millie Harris is doing over there at Central High School. What do you think? Did you happen to hear her?
I didn't hear.
Oh, you didn't hear?
No.
What she's doing is they have a social, she's teaching a social justice course or a segment of it. We're probably going to try to have her back in here for a minute. And they're talking about the experiences of children whose parents were incarcerated.
Okay.
During that particular time. And suppose you give us a rundown, you know, catch us up again about your story, what happened to you and why.
It was 2000, it wasn't 2000, it was 1992. I was arrested October 20th in the Philippines for drug trafficking, and I got out of prison September 2000, it's 8 year span, and...
What happened to you during that time when you were in prison?
A lot of different things happened to me. When I first got there, they tortured me through electricity. They broke both of my front spleens and my legs and electrocuted me basically through water and different things. And they beat me, but I survived it. So
you certainly did. 8 years. That's a long time. Were you allowed any visits? Were you allowed callers? Were you allowed letters or what?
Yes, I was allowed visits, but who's going to visit me? I'm in the Philippines,
yeah.
And all my family was in America, and I really wanted to see my sons more than anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that I survived for,
yeah.
To see my sons again, because I knew I would.
Yeah. Let's take it back to why you got involved with the drug trafficking.
Well, I was raised in, I have twin boys,
mm-hmm.
and I was raised in two young black men in Newark,
mm-hmm.
and I seen what Newark was going to be. So I didn't want to raise them, you know, in that environment. So I basically wanted to make some quick money, which is bad, to take my sons out of Newark, move them off somewhere in the country, send them to private schools, and give them a better upbringing than what I saw that was coming.
Mm-hmm. So that's how all that happened.
Yes, that's
And Hanif, you were a kid.
Yeah, at the time I was about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
It was rough. It was real rough. It's crazy because before it happened, I kind of knew. I had a premonition, a visual of her being locked in a prison.
Really?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember standing where we were staying at her friend house, April, and I could just remember just getting real, real sad for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the vision just came to me that my mother was in a cell.
Mm-hmm.
Looking sad.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point on, I knew something wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
And
at that point, how long had she been gone?
At that point, maybe about a week and a half,
mm-hmm.
because she was supposed to be gone for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. Maybe about a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt something. Something wasn't right.
Yeah.
And it was rough.
Yeah.
My father took over at the time, and his rules and her rules is two totally different rules.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? So it was a rough transition. It was.
Now, did you hear the Millie Harris, the teacher who was just on? Did you hear that? Were you able to hear that discussion when you were out in the
bits and pieces?
Yeah, yeah. Now, what she's doing in the school system, Sahin, is the kind of thing that I know that you are interested in doing also. She was she has a program over there at Central High School that deals with students, kids whose parents, either one or two or both, or, you know, other people in the family being incarcerated and dealing with those kids with those experiences. What happened was that they finally got these kids to open up and talk about it, you know, and share their experiences. Because as you were saying, you know, you didn't know what happened, but something happened.
Yes, I did,
and you knew that, you know, something was wrong. So you think that's a good idea for them to, you know, really work on these kids to get them to talk about this and get this?
Well, your talking is always good.
Yeah.
You know, I think. It's not good to hold in stuff, because if you do, you'll act it out in some type of way. Some people do it in a negative way, some people do it in a positive way. I took the route, the positive way. My brother took the route of the negative way.
Well, how is it that you went in one direction and he went in the other?
I don't know. I guess I just went with something I felt. You know, I kind of feared my father. So, you know, fear is a good thing. It was good for me, but it wasn't good for my brother. I know. I guess each individual is different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I took more of the positive route. My brother took more of the negative route.
Mm-hmm. And Fahim, I know that you're interested now in talking to young ladies, you know, to let them know the things that they shouldn't do. You know, involved in, because the drugs is everywhere.
Yes, and
face it,
it looks, it sounds so simple,
yeah.
So easy. Nobody thinks they're going to get caught.
Yeah,
but. You will get caught.
Yeah.
And with, since 9/11 is really, you know, the screenings and stuff that they go through, it's even easier to get caught now than it was back in 92.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't suggest anyone even try it. You know, it looks good. It looks easy, but it's a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a dead end. And the laws have changed in the Philippines. The sentence that I had was life.
Mm-hmm.
Now the law is death.
Mm-hmm.
And the law came in 6 months after I was sentenced for the same crime.
Wow.
So I like skipped that by then in my tooth.
But the law in the Philippines was death for, you know, bringing in drugs? Or
yes, six months after I was sentenced.
Yes. So how did they overturn that or what?
It wasn't the death when I came there.
Oh, I see.
Six months
after
I was there, it became the death penalty for the same crime that I committed.
Yeah.
And they did try to kill a girl, but we fought, we did visuals, because I looked at it as, if they kill her and she's a Filipino, what do they care about me?
Mm-hmm.
I would never come out. Mm-hmm. You know, even I had life imprisonment. They're not going to let me go, and they killed one of their own people.
Yeah. How did you function? You know, was it, you were in a Philippine prison.
Yes.
And you didn't speak Filipino.
I learned Tagalog and Bisaya and Ilonggo. I did, and I speak it fluent now.
Wow.
I had to learn the language.
So three different dialects of the Philippine language you now speak.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I had to learn it because, you know, a lot of them are uneducated, and they come from these faraway provinces, and they do not know English, when English is supposed to be their second language, but they do not learn know English. So I've got tired of pointing and touching. So I finally basically broke down and learned the language, because I like shut myself off and blamed everybody but who I should have been blaming myself, you know. But then I had a dream, a vision, because I was at that end. And a dream, it was, I don't know if it was a lady, an angel, but she said to me three words: improvise, sacrifice, and adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I learned the language, and I started adapting to the culture, and, you know, I sacrificed not being able to be with my sons, and, you know, I had to do that, and I couldn't think about what was going on outside.
Yeah.
When I basically did, all I worried about was my sons. If they were there with me, I think I could have stayed there for life.
So you were doing, you know, what you had to do to survive, learn the language and, you know.
Yes, the culture and the food, because it's totally different. You don't even have proper running water. You don't have showers. You know, you have to squat down with cold water, you know, and everything you have to pay for. And Hanif and his father sent me money every month for 8 years.
Boy.
And that was a part of survival, because I couldn't eat their food.
Yeah.
Because their food was filthy. So I had to buy and prepare my own food. And that didn't happen until after a couple of years. But when I first got there, I had to sleep on concrete on a mat, a wicker mat that was full with bed bugs. And I didn't know what bed bugs was. I had head lice. I shaved my hair to the scalp. You know, got in trouble for it, but I did it. They said it's against the rules, so. But
well, they couldn't put the hair back on you.
No, so they just locked me. You know, I stayed in the quarantine, Vaselina, with the holding cell. And I said I would prefer to stay there, because I didn't have to be around people. I didn't trust. I didn't sleep, you know.
Did you sort of close yourself off from, you know, being in touch with other people's communication and all that sort of stuff, because you couldn't communicate, or because you didn't want to, or?
Well, the first 4 years, I did not want to learn the language. I did not want to learn the culture. I wanted out. I wanted to go home. And everybody was saying, oh, you're American. You'll be home. You're going to go home. You're going to go home. But then after my sentence was affirmed after 3 years, because it's automatically, when it's life, it automatically goes on an appeal. And after 3 years, they said it was affirmed. But that didn't make me not knowing that I was going to go home. I had faith in God. And I knew he would, that wasn't my destiny. And I knew I would see my sons again. But I never wanted them to come there. I don't think I could have handled them leaving after that.
Now, are you interested in doing, because some people have asked, are you interested in doing speaking engagements? Is that what you're going to be doing, you know, with some of the young females, you know, in different schools or what? So some of them don't know. They really don't know exactly what they could possibly get into, because it's happening more and more because of because of poverty. Let's face it.
Yeah.
A lot to do with it.
Yeah, it was about survival then, because I was working two
jobs.
And then,
you know, with so many things being cut for programs for the youth, you know, in various areas, you know,
I don't mind doing that at all. You know, I would love to do speaking against, because if I can help one person to not go through what I went through, you know, I would love to do it. No problem.
Yeah. What do you say, Henny, to all this? What do you feel?
Well, as far as her speaking, her experience,
anything
to help. I think it'd be a good thing, because, you know, you take what you go through, and it's best to, you know, spread and make something positive about the situation.
Yeah, and you certainly have a story to tell. and also lessons are to be learned, you know, through you, Fahima.
Yes, because, you know, people be like, wow, this and that. But I never looked at it as a great thing, even when it happened. I've never, you know, praised the fact that I was doing bad things because that wasn't, my intention. And I'm, you know, the bottom line is I'm happy that the drugs never met America because when I came home, I seen so many things that I didn't see before then. Because my monologue then was supply and demand.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to get it anyway. But now I look at it and I see so many women and men that strung out off of heroin and pregnant.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's so sad to me. And I'm so glad that mine did not meet America.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back, everybody. Stay with us. A closer look here with Kate Thompson and Gus Henningberg. The story of Fahima with her son Hani. We will be right back, everyone.
I have no faith, as long as the truth is deep. Even though it's like poison, they will never silence me. Cause I have no faith, as long as the truth is deep. When dreams crumble into dust and nameless ones do what they must, even if it means dying still, yeah, one voice raised in protest, ooh, can only lay to rest. Freedom, lies and deception, find your strength within. I don't have no giving. Long as God is with you, no one can stand against you. Even though it's like poison, they will never silence me. Cause I have no faith, long as the truth is here. Even though it's like poison, never silence me, cause I have no faith, long as the truth is. Anywhere futures fade to black, those stolen lives can't be given back to the ones who are left here to grieve. Though the world don't know your name, unaware of your sadness and pain, I'm gonna teach them a lesson. I will sing your song. I'm gonna sing your story loud and strong for everyone in the world to hear. Yes, I will, yes, I will.
I'm gonna have no fear. as long as the truth is you. I ain't gonna have no
okay, we are.
Okay, we are back. Kay Toms with Gus Henningberg here on A Closer Look with Kay and Gus, the Kay and Gus Show. And you can get us if you go to Blog Talk Radio. And then you type in the Kay and Gus Show, blogtalkradio.com, the Kay and Gus Show. My first name is spelled K-A-E, so in case you're going to be typing in K-A-Y, it's not going to work, y'all. So please do K-A-E. And Fahim is still with us, and so is Hanif, her son. We want to thank you both for coming. But you know one thing I have to ask you, when you finally found out that you were coming home, how did that happen? I mean, how is it? Who helped you? And, you know.
Well, I don't want to really say names, but I had.
Was it Amnesty International also helping?
No.
Or what?
No. It was through the American Embassy. And I had presidential pardon with voluntary deportation, but it's more into that, but I can't really give names of people. Then. They told me I was coming home so many times. To the last time, I was stuck, but I knew it was true. And first thing I did was call my son, Hanif, and I told him I was coming home. But I was in a dream world maybe for about 3 months after that. I was still, like, fading out, not
bleeding. You mean when you came back home?
Yeah. It was like I was dreaming because you constantly dream that you're home.
Yeah.
You know, and then I got to get adjusted. I left a little boy, and now I got a man.
Yeah.
You know, it was all shocking to me. And I was homeless, basically, when I first came home. I had nothing. I had my sons, but they were young men, and they stayed with their father. And I had to rebuild everything. I had to start over. But I'm happy I started over. Sometimes starting over is better.
Yeah.
But I don't wish that experience on anyone. And I don't justify anything that I did. I was wrong.
You
and
take full responsibility for it.
Yes, definitely. You live, you learn. I mean, you learn different ways, and I don't justify that.
Yeah.
It was wrong, you know.
Hanif, when you found out that your mother was coming home, what was your reaction?
I didn't believe it at first.
How old were you, by the way?
I was 18.
18?
I was in denial, like, because I've been hearing throughout the years, oh, she's coming home, she's coming home, she's coming home.
Yeah.
But she would never come home, so after a while, I lost hope. I just accepted, all right, she's not coming home. Because, you know. But I was in denial for a long time. And when she did come home, I seen her, but I was like, she's there, but she's not there.
Did she look the way that you expected her to look, or what?
She looked a little older, and she gained weight. She gained some weight, I guess, you know, like rice.
And did she look the way you expected him to look?
No, I didn't know what to expect. I had pictures of him growing, you know, he was sending me pictures through the years. And but when I actually seen him, I'm still looking for a little boy.
Yeah.
Even my dreams was of my children when they were small, even they were grown. You know, it was a shock. Then the strangest thing happened to me, because after I found out that I couldn't go back to where I was, I cried. And a guy came up to me, and I've never seen this guy in my life. He said, you know, after all you've been through, keep your head up. Everything will be all right. And then I'm like, everything I've been through. And when I turned to look, the guy was gone.
No kidding. Wow.
Nobody was in the airport at the time. And when Hanif got there, strange, because he locked his keys in the car. With the car running. Nobody was there. It was like an empty airport. It was weird. It was really, really strange. Then we had to get his keys out the car. But I wanted to thank this guy and ask this guy, how do you know what I've been through? So I think it was an angel. You know, because I believe in angels, and they come to me all the time. And that's what got me through. You know, faith endures pain.
Wow. That's some story. Glad to hear.
No problem.
And you're also one of the most talented people I know, too.
Really?
Of course. Are you kidding? Of course. You know, with the things that you do, the What? How many businesses have you had? You're very resourceful.
Yeah, so I'm going to make a dollar. The legal way. I'm not trying. I'm scared straight. Don't want to leave the country. I told you homophobic, all that good stuff. I only want to do positive things. I don't want nothing negative. You go through things, and some people learn and some people don't.
Yeah.
And I learn.
Yeah.
You know, I want to see my grandchildren grow up now.
Yeah.
I got 3 grandchildren, and I want to see them grow up.
I know. They're adorable. They're absolutely adorable.
Yeah, I want to see them.
Are you going to be writing a book? This is your first time telling the story.
First time.
And you are going to be writing a book.
Definitely.
And who knows? A movie.
Yes.
Is probably
definitely
in the making.
Yeah,
because we haven't even touched on some of the things
you
went through, really.
No, not at all.
You have told me, so it's quite an interesting story.
Yeah, 8 years, every day, all those days. A lot of things happen in that country.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of mysterious things. A lot of dying.
Mm-hmm.
Because
they're
lack
in the
of
jail
medicine.
Itself, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of no money, no medicine, and hangings. You know, one girl hung herself, and another one got hung. And I saw these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I got to keep your head up and be strong.
So have you been preparing, putting anything in writing? Or are you taking notes or what? You making an outline or something or what?
Basically, I do have a outline. I had someone that was starting it, but she tried to rob me without a gun. So I had to cut her off. And so I'm starting all over from scratch.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But at that time, it was hard for me to talk about it because I constantly dreamed I was back there. I was going through my demons within myself, but now I don't forget nothing, so I remember basically all of it.
And how long did it take you when you got on the plane, and did you really believe that you were going in the Philippines when they said
when they told me that I was going, I knew I was going because they said pack your things, don't tell anybody, because they didn't want the media to come in, because if the media came in, they would have stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely would have stopped it,
mm-hmm.
you know. Mm-hmm. So we had to rush. It was all rush thing. And I was from the institution to immigration to the airport.
Yeah.
And it took 22 hours in the air.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you didn't care.
No, I still didn't know this was true. I thought this was all a dream.
Yeah.
And I tried to wake up for 3 months. And then when I finally woke up, I realized, well, this
that
is
you're
really,
really
true.
Really
yeah. This is really, really true. Mm-hmm.
Now, you said you were homeless for a while. What did you do?
What did I do?
Where did you live?
Wherever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I found a place, and I'm not homeless now.
You're doing quite well. Thank you.
You know good people. People help you out.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I've always set a good example on people and
Well, you've also helped a whole lot of people out.
Yeah, that's what I did, and it came back.
Sure.
It came back.
What goes around comes around.
Right.
Yeah.
And I knew the right people.
Thank you, honey.
Thank you.
You sure are handsome.
Thank you.
That's Henny Bird.
I appreciate that.
So, what do you think?
What do you mean if he's handsome?
What do you think?
Are you asking me if he's handsome? I hadn't noticed.
Anyway, Kay Thompson, Gus Henneberg, A Closer Look. Join us again next Wednesday, 8 o'clock. We'll be here. Is this the end of the show or not, or what? We will talk to you later. Oh, we do have another segment. Okay, because I'm not seeing things here. We will talk to you later. Okay? Stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back, everyone. Kay Thompson with Gus Hedenberg here for a closer look. And we are into another portion of the show. You know, I'm sorry that I got the time mixed up here. I'm still learning this new... You know, when you go on the internet and you're not used to using the internet the way we're using it to do Blog Talk Radio, it is a learning experience for me. And it's really a wonderful, absolutely wonderful way, you know, to get to the public again. In doing talk radio on radio in New York is completely different. You know, I mean, before I didn't have to worry about, well, the mics were there, of course, but I didn't have to worry about that there, this here, looking here, looking there. It's really fascinating. So I've learned a lot through folks here at Black Wax, everybody. I'm going to be talking to Nana Soul, Ayanna Jones, about that right now. And Gus Hedenberg, this is a different kind of experience, isn't it?
It sure is.
Because all of a sudden, we're global. You know, I mean, I think that fully hasn't really, you know, affected us. That we're not only heard in the New York, New Jersey area, not in the Tri-State metropolitan area, but we're heard from here to California, to Bermuda, to wherever people can listen in. And I'd like to, for someone to call and tell me where they're calling from, you know, because I know a lot of people are listening.
Well, I was on the air, I assumed that the entire distance was from Queens to Newark. No further than that, in either direction.
Uh-huh. And?
I'm not accustomed to this.
You're not accustomed to this yet?
No.
Oh, you mean to this? Yeah. It's strange. What do you say, Angela Christmas? You teach in Newark?
I think it's fabulous.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely fabulous that you're reaching so many people,
mm-hmm,
and getting the word out and about what's going on in our community.
Yeah.
We need this.
Yeah. And we're going to be zeroing in. We talk a lot about Newark because there's so much going on in New Jersey, and especially in Newark. A lot of people give Newark a bad rap. And in some instances, it is well-deserved. But the school system is pretty good. Okay, there's a whole lot of good things going on. I know so many darn good teachers. You know, the educational system is good. I don't care what anybody says, whether there's vouchers or charges. There's a lot of things going on in Newark right now, and teachers are absolutely fantastic. Sure, you have some bad apples everywhere in every single profession or, you know,
that's true.
Employment area.
Where would the challenge be?
Yeah, exactly.
If there
were. But if you have a love of education and a love of kids, you know, you're a winner.
Yeah.
You know, and to hear what Millie is doing over there at Central High School. And I've been in Central High School. I'm so impressed with that school. Science Tech, Science High. Wow. I mean, New York is a, you know, hotbed of education. It is really. So, Nana Soul,
yes,
you're with Black Wax.
I am.
Tell us about Black Wax.
Well, we are an independent multimedia company. We started out as a record label in Brooklyn. We had a little small walk-up. The keyboard was practically in the kitchen, as you say, you like to joke. And we expanded.
He wasn't joking.
Well, he said it with a smile. That's what I mean. But it was absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
And but, you know, we managed to get our hands into television. And then after that, film. And we're working on documentaries and narratives this year. Actually, we're going to be working on a horror film and a sci-fi at the same time. Very
wow.
Ambitious.
Uh-huh.
And it's just been an amazing journey, because any way that you can reach people with any kind of message, whether it's audio, visual, it's important, because that's the way in which you can change the world. I firmly believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe sometimes even more so than politics.
Yeah.
You know, if you can reach somebody's heartstrings with a story or a song, you can get them. And then you can fill them with whatever politics
absolutely.
You want.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And could I just say one other thing? Because, you know, you said something really interesting, and I think a lot of people who
only one thing I said interesting?
Well, you see how you can't mess with Kay? What's interesting is that a lot of people like you guys come from, you know, television and terrestrial radio, traditional radio. They always, you know, talk bad about internet radio and say, oh, it's not, we need to go back to, you know, and I just really commend you guys, because you're like, whatever way we can get on the airwaves and talk to people, if that means moving into the future, into the digital, then we're going to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it's great, because we need the Kay and Gus show on the air in whatever way that it can reach people. Not just people from your traditional demographic, but young people, too.
Yeah,
because you have
absolutely.
Relevant stories. Hearing what you did just in Newark, people could take that model all over the world.
Absolutely.
So I'm just really proud of you guys.
Absolutely. You know, I also had a business in Newark, too. The Thompson Dance Studio. You know, and then Universal Multimedia Systems. And you had where we which were teaching TV production with the school system.
Right,
at the same time, I was broadcasting in New York and New Jersey.
By bringing the media right to the classroom, to the kids, getting them started early.
I was very excited. That was so gratifying because what I did in developing, creating, and developing that educational program of the Electronic Media Development for Learning program was because of the fact that I had gotten into broadcasting accidentally. It was by pure accident, you know. And it was because of Pat Atwell and a friend of his, I forget his name, Shabazz. I forget his name, from Staten Island. I met him at Madison Square Garden when there was a black rodeo going on, or black rodeo coming into Madison, you know. And I was there because I was working for Channel 47 at the time, Canal 40 NBC, Spanish TV. And of course, they thought I was Latina. I spoke no Spanish. Still don't. I remember one of those ladies.
Then or now?
One of the ladies asked. She said, "Oh," she said, "can you're Latina?" She said, "I was telling her I was going on vacation, you know." And so she said, "Oh, I know where you are going. You are going to Puerto Rico. Don't, I won't tell nobody. You don't deny your heritage." I said, "I'm going to Virginia." Have you heard of Caswell? But it was big fun, and just really got into it accidentally, you know. So it was just,
yeah, but just think about that spark that you might have started for a child.
Yeah, I was always getting
that it's not an accident.
Excited.
They actually have an interest now, and it's accessible.
Well,
to
you're
them.
Doing that now. You know, I think it's because of my course that time.
So
what we're doing was I was teaching the students, and I started out teaching the teachers how to produce television programming as an alternative method of teaching academic subjects. You know, because I found out that our kids watch between 7 or 10 hours of television per day. Even then, this is like about 20, some more than 20 years ago. You're young, Nanny.
Yes, I am.
You know.
But anyway,
but this was a long time ago, and it worked. You know, because once the teachers got involved with, I remember asking teachers, and I just took this stuff off the top of my head and said, "What have you always wanted to do?" When there's about 60 or 70 teachers that had taken the course initially anyway. And I said, "What is this thing you've always wanted to do? Put yourself on television. I want to put you on television." So they said, "Yes, you're fine." I said, "Well, what's the thing you've always wanted to do?" One woman said, she said, "Well, I've always wanted to, you know, have a restaurant." Another person said, "Well, I've always wanted to be a traveling agent, you know, travel." And I said, "Well, see yourself on television." Because remember, television too, at that time, dealing with them, teaching was relatively new. There were a few people before me who did it, but they hadn't gone to the level that I had gone to. I was bored in the school system, really. So I used to teach the kids different things by having them dance through, because, you know, I was going to be prima ballerina of the Western world at one time. World wasn't ready. But anyway, so I would have them dance their parts, you know, and dance the subjects, you know, when they learned about the universe. And the planets and whatnot, they became the planets. They became the universe. So, and that was an alternative way of teaching, but they remembered it. And I remembered also just telling them that they had to do homework on the weekend. That didn't go over too big with parents. In fact, I think I got called a couple of days. Yeah, so I told the kids to bring money and we would buy the New York Times. They had to pay for the New York Times for a full week, and they had to save them in a room in their house. And I gave him a weekend exam, and I wrote out the questions. I mean, boy, I was doing so much work. And
so that's why you're not teaching
anymore. Yeah, they kicked me out. No.
Now you're teaching on the K and Gusta.
Yeah, how about that? But, you know, they had to do this exam, and I would take some questions out of each and every single day from the time. That's why they had to buy a full week. And then they had to buy a bulletin board. Well, the parents used to call me names that were not nice. They said, "We don't need her to bond with our kids." Anyway, the kids loved it because they had to put their stories on this big bulletin board. But, you know, all crazy stuff, but it worked. I bore very easily.
Whatever it works.
Whatever works. I always used to tell people on WLID, when you call me, whatever you do, don't bore me. You know, if you make me bore, if you bore me, I'm hanging up. That's, you know, that's the bulletin. You know. But it was really, that was really fun. And teaching is a profession that you really have to want to go into. And bringing information to people, information that they can use. For instance, we have a lot of things involved with our health now, you know, and with Gus and I being a little older, than we used to be. You know, we are very concerned with health issues and with people getting their pensions and with people making sure that they are, you know, getting proper diagnosis and, you know, having a healthy lifestyle. I used to have the Thompson Dance Studio with a ton of students, and I'm used to doing exercise and a lot of dance and whatnot. As a matter of fact, when Alvin Ailey's dance company was at PAX not too long ago, they were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the of Alvin's revelation. Well, I hate to say this, but 50 years ago, I saw the first performance of Revelations. Yeah, it was. It was in New York somewhere. Maybe it's 92nd Street Y or City Center. But I remember Alvin going to Europe. And when he came back, Gus, you had called me. You know, we knew Gus from our sorority, you know, since everybody was in love with Gus Henningberg, right? And what?
We knew Gus because our sorority.
Yeah, yeah. Kids in our sorority. We
I
were
was
kids
not
then.
In the sorority.
No, you were
I
not.
Want to be clear. But go ahead and
but
finish.
The sorority. Your in an official or unofficial capacity.
Either way.
I'm not touching that. But anyway, we had gotten involved. See, maybe this is my trend of thought. But anyway, what was I talking about? Alvin. So. Anyway, I happened to go to City Center or wherever he was performing the Alvin Ailey Revelations. And I love that choreography. So I'm not even gonna, maybe I shouldn't say this. Did I say this last year? How I stole his choreography and taught my students, you know, as much as I could Revelations at the Thompson Dance Studio. We used to do these big concerts at Symphony Hall. And at one time we had over 500 students, and, you know, the best way to organize something for a huge concert is to use teachers. Am I right?
Yes.
Because we know how to organize. We know how to bring large groups into an assembly hall. Mm-hmm. We know how to seat them.
Right.
And we know where they should be seated. And
I'm famous for my list at Newton.
Absolutely. And so I got some of my sister and I. We're co-founders of the Thompson Dance Studio and preschool. It was a family business with my mom and dad and with my kids and whatnot. And
well, I think when you're giving them the background, you should tell them the story about the concert you did at Symphony Hall with the horse.
Oh, with the horses.
Horses.
You know, Phil Thomas doesn't believe that to this day. Yes, Phil Thomas. There was a live horse.
Nobody knows who Phil Thomas is.
Yeah, Phil. You don't rate. Sorry, Phil. Yes, you do. He is the director of Symphony Hall right now. And he used to be with New Jersey Performing Arts Center, but he's a good friend. And Phil does not believe that there was a horse on the stage at Symphony Hall, downtown Newark, for one of our concerts. And the horse came down the aisle from the front and plop, 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 went up the side stage, up those stairs, and promptly peed on the floor. And it got on stage and also pooped on stage. And there are two prominent people who were very young at the time that we sent out. This was during a concert. The concert had a theme. Every single concert for the Thompson Dance Studio had a theme. Brasilia, Batuacada, we called it, with fantastic Brazilian music and jazz. When I love Brazilian music and jazz. I remember dancing on stage and my hairpiece fell off. And I was going like this and boom, the piece just fell off. And, but anyway, yeah, that's how the horse was brought on stage. And the horse was supplied by Ronnie Wright, who had a stable in Newark that went on. And so it was a successful kind of, we used to
because
have
of the
standing
horse?
Room. Well, because of the Thompson Dance, there were all those students, you know. So it was a big thing, and we didn't realize it was a big thing because we were having fun.
Interesting.
Yeah, we were doing what we always did. You know, we had dance lessons, and, you know, we studied dance. And, you know, I studied with Donald McHale, you know, met Alvin Ailey, Kathy Grant, Thelma Hill, Charles Moore, Ella Moore, Chuck Davis, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on and on to those people, you know, who know dance. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, people are Facebooking me, is that the way to say it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about Clark Center, which was a place where everybody who was involved in dance you know, especially if you study with Alvin, or you study with Fred Benjamin or Avia Palmieri or, you know, Pepsi Bethel. It was a crazy life, but it looked like fame. We would come out of there, we'd be dancing in the streets and jumping on the cars and whatnot, really. So when I tell people, I say, yeah, my life is like fame. At the same time, I was teaching school, you know, and then toward the end of the school, you know, teaching school, and I happened to fall into broadcasting accidentally, you know, because of Pat Atwell. Where are you, Pat? And Saeed Shabazz, yeah, I'm just now remembering his name from Staten Island. He said, well, would you like to do a radio show? And I said, no. And he said, well, come on, you know, and see, you know, we'll talk about sports. I said, I don't know anything about sports. I knew tennis, you know, and I knew a little bit about horses, you know. And so I got on the air, and Pat Outlaw was talking about boxing. Now, they expected me to talk about boxing. Now, I didn't know what to do on radio. I had no idea. It was just a lark. I thought, okay, I'll go. And so the calls were coming in, and Pat wanted me to comment, and so did Saeed Shabazz want me to comment on boxing. So I popped up with, it's the most brutal, paganistic thing I have ever seen. Two grown men pummeling each other, killing each other. Oh, every single light lit up. I guess they wanted to get me off. He said, anyway, the guys were calling in saying, where did you come from? But Pat said, you've got to come back, because, you know, the audience, yeah, it started something. That's how I really started, WID. Yeah, that's the different other stations. That was a different thing. How did you start at Positively Glad?
I was sitting in my office.
Minding my business.
In Newark.
Uh-huh.
One night.
Uh-huh.
Minding my own business.
Uh-huh.
Mushroom 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone rang, and normally I don't answer the phone that late unless I'm expecting a call.
Uh-huh.
And I was, so I answered the phone, mm-hmm. and it was not the person I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody from NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And we chatted, and I said, you know, it's almost 10 o'clock. Why'd you call me? He said, how would you like to be on television? And I said, sounds like fun. Call me when the sun is up. You know, when it's daylight outdoors. And he said, well, we need an answer right now. And I said, well, what are we talking about? I had no interest in television. I had no history in television. And he said, we want you to be the co-host of a show called Positively Black.
Mm.
It's on NBC already.
Mm.
And
2 minutes ago.
And I knew the show. I knew the host, a guy named Gene Callender, who ran the Urban Coalition in New York as I ran the Urban Coalition in Newark. And I knew this didn't come from Gene Callender. We knew each other well enough to know this was not his idea. But I said, sure, sounds like fun. But you got to talk to Gene Callender first. He said, I'll call you right back. Literally, he called me right back, 11 o'clock at night. Gene thinks it's a wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew Gene better than that. I knew what had happened. They had called him up and said, he is going to be your co-host.
You got to move over.
And sure enough, the next morning, I went over there and sat next to Gene Callender, and that's how I ended up on Positively Glad.
Yay! That's your future. But, you know, we have a lot of...
I had no idea people got paid for that.
Yeah. Oh. Hey. Well, I'll tell you one thing. I used to love television so much, I probably would have done it for nothing. And I know better now. I knew when I was on WLIB and we started doing Breakfast Club, and when Adrian Council, who is one of the publishers of Positive Community Magazine, came to me and said, Kay, we are in the market zone. What is it called when you're on the air and, you know, the Wall Street people are looking at you, the Madison Avenue advertisers are looking at you. And he said, boy, Brian, now we're going to make a lot of more money in advertising. And I'm thinking, oh, fine. Okay, what am I getting to raise? Wrong person to ask. But anyway, you know, it's a lot to these stories. By the way, Gus and I are going to be supplying our video tapes that we have. you know, the different shows that we've done, and they're close to, I guess, about very close to 2,000 different shows and conversations. And that's why I'm so interested in finding Dr. Ben again. He's a dear, dear friend, and but we're getting close to ending. But thanks to Black Rat.
Thank you.
Because without you guys, I probably wouldn't. I wonder if Eric is listening out there in California. Lisa and Gina, Brianna. Thank you.
Thank you.
Angela, Christmas, thank you. You're going to be coming back again because we're going to be doing another thing. Well, Gus Henningberg, another closer look. What do you say?
Well, nice talking to you.
Join us again, everybody, for a closer look to Kay Thompson and Gus Henningberg. Please listen next Wednesday at 8 p.m. And we will again be on either for 1 hour or 2 hours again. Okay, and we'll have a lot more interesting things. 2 hours, okay. And we will give out the calling, the number to call, and by then we will probably have that on track. So, and then we'll start including some of our experiences with some of these stories because they are fascinating. For instance, the stuff with Nelson Mandela, Reverend Y.T. Walker, where he was when he found out that Dr. King, you know, my interview with Rosa Parks, Gus's interview with Adam Clayton Powell, all that, so many, many things, you know. So, join us again for a closer look with Kay Thompson and Gus Henninger, Ayanna Soul, Ty Washington, Shona Glover, shall I go on? Angela, Sahima, shall I go on and on? The show is being produced right here at Black Wax Productions. Black Wax Moving Images. What is it?
It's BW Moving Images. You can check us out on the web at www.blackwax.com. BLACKWAX.com.
Say it again.
Oh, I was saying it all fast. Okay. BlackWax.com. BLACKWAX.com. BW Moving Images. Right here in New Jersey.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Join us again.
Stand up for your rights.